This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Last night, Governor Daniel Malloy declared a state of emergency because of salt shortages throughout the state's municipalities. Some cities and towns are in better shape than others, including New Haven, where their salt is locally sourced.
We're not screaming shortage in the city of New Haven with salt. We have a great resource in New Haven Harbor at the terminal, so we get our salt. It's pretty readily available.
That's Rick Fontana. He's director of the New Haven Emergency Operations Center, but he says the Elm City has not received requests from other local governments.
The fact is transportation as well. So, you know, if you had a big vehicle and you can get down to the terminal, and they, load you up into a triax and get it that way. But unfortunately, you know, with the weather, the roadways are being tough, and it just holds up delivery.
Senator Richard Blumenthal will be meeting with Fontana and other local officials in New Haven to discuss Governor Malloy's request for federal assistance. That's a request that he made last night. Throughout the course of the day, the roadways should get better because temperatures are expected to rise. There's more snowfall expected over this weekend, but not anywhere near as much as we've had over the course of the last 24 hours or so. Coming up later in the program, we hope to get an update from Senator Blumenthal about that federal request for assistance, and you can join us at 860-275-7266. If you've noticed road salt shortages in your town, how has it been on the roadways today? Has it been a huge problem for you getting around because there's not enough salt to clear the roads? Again, 860-275-7266. You can also email us where we live at wnpr.org. Today, though, we wanted to have a different conversation about a salty treat. Maybe go out for oysters for Valentine's Day? Cooked or raw, oysters have been a favorite treat among seafood lovers. They're part of an industry with an extensive history here in Connecticut. So we're going to delve into that history today, which is currently on display at the Bruce Museum in Greenwich. Oysters, pearls of Long Island Sound. We'll discuss the roles oysters play in our economy and ecosystem as well. Later on, we'll be talking with a filmmaker about her film called Vanishing Pearls, The Oysterman of Point of La Hache, which documents the impact of the 2010 BP oil spill on the South's oyster industry. But first, I want to welcome in Kathleen Holko, who's manager of school and tour services at Bruce Museum in Greenwich. Kathleen, welcome to our show.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So first of all, where did this idea for the exhibit come from? Why oysters?
The idea came from one of my colleagues at the Bruce who just really loved to eat oysters. And looking a little bit more into the topic of oysters, particularly the eastern oyster in Long Island Sound, we found that it is not only an important part of the local ecosystem, but that oyster fishing has a rich history along the Sound.
Well, tell us a little bit about that history. I mean, obviously, people have been eating oysters for hundreds, thousands of years, but how far back does this industry go in Connecticut?
The consumption of oysters actually goes back to the Native Americans, and Native Americans consumed vast quantities of oysters along the Sound, and this is really evident through shell middens, which are essentially trash heaps filled with shells from not only oysters but clams. And these shell middens that archaeologists have found along the Sound are huge, and so they really give us a great idea of how important oysters were as a food source for the Native Americans living along the Sound.
This is really interesting, an important food source for the Native Americans living on the Sound, because we think of oysters today as a delicacy, something that you get with a really fancy dinner. They're like $2.50
a
piece. It's an entirely different sort of way of consuming it. So take us back to the day in which you would actually often crack open an oyster to get a good source of protein.
Yeah, well, essentially what Native Americans, well, an important thing to know is that oysters are really grow very easily along Long Island Sound. So during the time of the Native Americans, the natural oyster beds were huge. So it was really a very accessible, easy food source for them. And essentially what they did to open them was they smoked them, and it allowed the shells to pop open, and then they consumed them. And sometimes what they did was they actually also then smoked and preserved the oyster meat, and it was a way for them to preserve it and have it as a protein source over the winter.
We're talking today with Kathleen Holko from the Bruce Museum in Greenwich. They've got a new exhibit, and it's called Oysters, Pearls of Long Island Sound. It's something that you can check out at the Bruce Museum. If you want to join us and tell us your oystering stories, especially if you've worked in this industry, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive@wnpr.org, or you can always tweet us at wherewelive. Well, as we move a little further through history, eventually oysters become something that is readily farmed. It becomes something that's a little bit more of an industry. What in your exhibit talks about that, about the fact that really an entire, you know, way of life is built around getting oysters out of the Sound?
Yeah, well, the Long Island Sound oyster industry really had its peak in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And so finding the tools and materials that oystermen used to collect oysters was really very easy for us to find from local historical societies like the Rowayton Historical Society and the city of Norwalk, for example. And it was really, it was an important part of our local economy, the farming and collection of oysters.
Tell us a little bit about some of the things that you'd see in this exhibit, because obviously there's a lot of history there, but you need to have things to see, things to put on display. I mean, yes, of course, we know about oysters and pearls, but oysters are pretty fascinating to look at anyway. Give us a sense of the visual style of this exhibit.
Yeah, well, this exhibition actually covers both the science and history of oysters in Long Island Sound. The first portion of the exhibition actually has some pearls in it, but one thing we cover in our exhibition is that the eastern oyster, the oyster you find in Long Island Sound, does not produce jewelry-quality pearls. Typically, those oysters that produce pearls are found in warmer waters. So we have a part of the exhibition that has a variety of different oysters and other types of bivalves, like clams and mussels. And we also have some pearls on display. But within the exhibition, we have a lot of other really interesting objects for people to look at. One of my colleagues at the Bruce, Sean Murtha, who's one of our exhibition designers, created a beautiful diorama of a natural oyster bed. And as an educator, this has been a really valuable piece we have in our exhibition. We've used it to talk to students and adults about the oyster's role within its local habitat and the other animals that it supports within its habitat and the animals within it that support the oyster as well. So a lot of really interesting things. We also have a beautiful painting by Child Hassam called Oyster Sloop Cos Cobb. It was painted in the early 1900s. Child Hassam was very involved with the Cos Cobb Art Colony in what is now the Bush Holly House in Greenwich. And the scene he paints and depicts in this painting is an oysterman either going out or coming in after a very long day, and was something he probably saw every day on Cos Cobb Harbor.
I want to bring into our conversation Bob Rowe, who's executive director of the East Coast Shellfish Growers Association, as we talk about the humble oyster today on the program. Bob Rowe, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We've been hearing a little bit about the history from Kathleen that's in this Bruce Museum exhibition. How long have you been working in the oystering business?
I started my farm about 30 years ago. I sold it about 5 years ago to become the executive director. Now I'm a lobbyist for the industry.
Well, how many people are making their living really growing and selling oysters along the Connecticut shoreline?
So in Connecticut, it's a relatively small number of firms. I believe there's 40 firms have got leases and are shellfish dealers in Connecticut. But I represent growers from Maine to Florida. Coastwide, there's over 1,000 small farms, mostly small mom and pops.
And these small mom and pops, are they selling oysters to just local restaurants, or are they shipping them all over the world?
Well, I mean, we ship, you know, all over the nation. Our exports are relatively minor, but you know, certainly once you get beyond a certain scale, the state is no longer able to absorb all the product that we're producing. So you need to be able to get it out into the heartland, you know, shipping into New York and D.C. and Chicago.
Well, I know, Kathleen, one of the things that you have to take a look at in your exhibition is some hard times for the oystering business. To talk about how you address the issues of maybe overfishing at a time in the oyster's history here, and then also some of the problems we've had with pollution or other contaminants in Long Island Sound. It's a big part of the history of the shellfish here.
Yes, absolutely. Well, there was certainly a time where overfishing was an issue for the oyster industry along Long Island Sound, but one of the biggest issues has been water pollution for the local oyster industry. As I mentioned, the height of the oyster industry in Connecticut was late 1800s, early 1900s, but this was also the time when Connecticut was really becoming an industrialized state and the population was growing. There's a story from the late 1800s where a group of students from Wesleyan University contracted typhoid from consuming oysters, and they tracked where these oysters were from. They were from the mouth of the Quinnipiac River, and unfortunately, that part of the Quinnipiac River was also an outlet for a sewer line coming from a home where the residents also had typhoid. And this is an example of a very early incident, but more stories like this started to pop up, and unfortunately, it kind of damaged the reputation of the oyster industry. And really, the water pollution was a problem for the oyster industry that really could not be addressed until laws like the Clean Water Act were passed in the early 70s. And luckily, since then, due to laws like that and really local efforts to clean up local waters, the oyster industry has been able to bounce back due to cleaner waters.
And how is the water situation, Bob Rowe, working for your industry right now? I mean, periodically we will see some sort of a problem with oxygen levels in Long Island Sound, or we will see something having to do with bacteria or contamination. How exactly is the cleanliness of Long Island Sound impacting the shellfishing industry right now?
Well, I mean, it's an integral part of what we do, and it clearly, you know, 100 years ago, we only had a very rudimentary understanding of what caused disease. Everybody thought you got sick from bad air, not from the oysters that were being held in the East River, along with, you know, thousands of tons of horse manure and other things. So the connection between bacteria and disease wasn't really appreciated until really the turn of the century. And absolutely correct. The Clean Water Act has been a critical force in terms of keeping our water quality acceptable for growing shellfish, and our understanding of how to manage our shellfish resources with the fact that we still do have giant sewage treatment plants along our shorelines, and periodically rainwater will overwhelm the capacity of those plants, and we'll have to close areas. But we've got it down to a science, and it's quite rare now that you actually hear about illnesses associated with sewage-borne pollutants.
Now, it's rare that you hear about any illnesses that people contract from oysters that they consume. But every once in a while, Bob, there is a disease that affects oysters. Back in the 1990s, we heard about MSX. Are there still diseases out there that may harm local oyster populations but not be harmful to humans?
Absolutely. And this has been one of the defining factors of the oyster populations on the East Coast for the last 100 years. There are a host of these parasitic organisms that will infect oysters, and it's been hugely a problem in the mid-Atlantic, where the populations are down to less than 1% of what they were at the turn of the century. And MSX and Dermo are the two primary culprits, but we've got about three other diseases that can pop up. And yes, they do have a tremendous impact when they hit. And one of the things that we as farmers are able to do is by selecting and selectively breeding the survivors of these epidemics, we're able to breed a race of stronger oysters that are able to tolerate or survive these epizootics when they occur. So we've got hatchery-reared lines of oysters that can tolerate MSX. And, you know, these diseases have been spreading up the coast as our waters warm gradually, so we've had outbreaks up into Atlantic Canada, even Maine and Massachusetts a few years ago suffered greatly. Long Island Sound had a huge epizootic about 10 or 15 years ago. It wiped out almost 90% of the population.
Well, in just a moment, we're going to be talking about oysters actually as food with a couple of local shellfish experts. Bob Rowe, before I let you go, how do you like to eat an oyster? Do you put anything on it, or you just slurp them right out of the shell?
Well, I'm a sort of a purist. I like to taste the oyster raw right out of the shell, but a little bit of citrus, like I prefer lime. It helps knock out your salt receptors in your mouth so that you can actually taste the rest of the flavors, because sometimes a nice fresh New England oyster, that the salt will overwhelm the other flavors. So that's why we have come to put a little bit of lemon or lime on our oysters. It just calms down your salt receptors and allows the other flavors to shine through.
Bob Rowe is Executive Director of the East Coast Shellfish Growers Association. Thanks so much, Bob, for growing us oysters.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I also want to thank Kathleen Holko, Manager of School and Tour Services at the Bruce Museum in Greenwich. Tell our listeners a little bit more about how they can get involved in this exhibit and how long it's there for.
The Oysters Pearls of Long Island Sound exhibition will be up until March 23rd. We do actually have two more lectures related to this exhibition coming up, in particular on Sunday, February 23rd. We have Elizabeth Perry, who is a Native American artist and marine scientist, who will be talking about Native maritime traditions, harvesting the sea. And we also have on March 9th, Tessa Getches from the Connecticut Sea Grant, discussing the history of shellfishing on Long Island Sound from the colonial times to the present. So you have a lot of opportunities to come in and learn more about oysters.
Excellent. Kathleen Holko from the Bruce Museum in Greenwich. We'll have more information on our website, WNPR.org. Thanks so much, Kathleen.
Thank you.
Now, when we come back, we'll be talking to some more oyster experts, people who actually work with oysters in the industry. We want to hear from you, 860-275-7266. Do you live along the shoreline? Are oysters a big part of your life? Maybe you work in the industry. We'd love to hear from you today, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about oysters. We learned about oyster history and oyster farming from someone who's been in the business for a while. We also heard a little bit about a historical exhibit that's happening at the Bruce Museum in Greenwich. But now to discuss oysters, it's the consumption piece of things. We're going to talk to a couple of people who are in the industry. Kim Koska is a professional oyster shucker for the Max Restaurant Group at Max Fish. I have downed just a few oysters at your establishments. Kim, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Thank you, John. Thank you for having me.
I also want to welcome back to our show Chris Prosperi. He's a recipe columnist at the Hartford Courant. He's, of course, a chef at Metro Beast Restaurant, and he's a regular on the Food Schmooze with Faith Middleton. Hey, Chris, how you doing?
Hey, John.
Well, I'm glad to have you guys both here. So I asked Bob this at the end of the first segment, but I'll ask you first, Chris, how do you like to eat oysters?
I like to eat them just as is.
Yeah, just nothing on them.
Nothing on them.
Yeah.
And especially, you know, and I like to get a variety so you can really taste the different kinds.
How about you, Kim? I mean, obviously, as you're shucking oysters, you're dealing with these precious little things. You probably hate it when people slather them with all sorts of sauce. I mean, what do you like to do?
Honestly, I'm right there with Chris. I'll eat them naked. If given the chance, I like to taste the difference in the flavors as well. There's so many subtle differences, even between farmers that are right next to each other, that it's an amazing, amazing experience to taste the natural flavors that come from the oysters.
So if we're looking for Connecticut oysters on your menu, Kim, I mean, what names would people be looking for so that they'd know they were getting something that was pretty locally sourced?
Oh, there's so many in Connecticut now. Probably my favorite would be the Noank oyster. It's grown by Arrow's Oyster Company there in Noank and Groton. There's also Ned's down in the Darien area. There's Briar Patch is another one. Blue Point is just an all-around term for an oyster grown in Connecticut, but there's a lot of smaller farmers here in Connecticut. They have their own little thing. There used to be one called Whale Rock, another great, great oyster. And if we're going right outside of Connecticut's Long Island Sound, Naked Cowboy is a great choice from Blue Island Oyster, and Dutch Islands are a nice choice as well.
So, Chris, when you're getting oysters for your restaurant, are you looking for things that are really grown locally, or because we can get fish taken from, you know, all over New England, really all over the world, that's going to taste very good and get to you very fresh, how do you decide what to put on the menu? Do you want to just keep it really local, or is it okay to move outside of New England now and again?
See, that's funny because at the restaurant, I always look for the ones closest to us because the first time I actually ate an oyster, I was a young chef, just got out of school, and I was in Florida and working in a restaurant, and the chef there said the best oysters for frying are ones that come from Connecticut. And I was like, what? And he's like, yeah, the Blue Point oyster. So that was my first experience. So that, I mean, I don't know. I always gravitate to those, which is totally different than when I'm eating oysters. Like when I'm eating oysters, I want to try different oysters from around the world.
This idea of the frying oyster, the oyster that would be good for something else other than just slurping off the half shell, what's the differentiation there, Chris? I mean, what makes a good frying oyster, and what's one that you really would want to be presented by Kim at Max?
All right, you know what? We're going to pass this on to Kim because Kim, in my mind, is the oyster goddess. Anything you want to know about an oyster, ask Kim.
Okay, so Kim, what do you think? What makes a frying oyster and what makes a really good, you know, regular old eating it cold oyster?
You know, when I'm picking oysters for frying, I go for a bigger oyster. You want to have a nice presentation on the plate, and you want to bite into something. You want something that's going to stand up to being fried and still have that nice, soft, creamy belly on the inside. So I do use a lot of Connecticut oysters for that. I use the Blue Points. I use the No-Angs. I use the Briar Patch, and that's always a good choice. We maybe will put a little coleslaw on the bottom. We could wrap them in bacon and maybe simmer them in barbecue sauce. There's just so many choices to do with them. Now, when it comes to a raw oyster, this is like my forte. The flavors are so ridiculously wonderful. There's regionally, Nova Scotia's got an oceany flavor, and Maine's got a nice clean flavor, and Washington State has a mineral flavor, and British Columbia has a beautiful floral cucumber, sometimes melon aftertaste. Our local oysters here have different levels of salinity, and they live in brackish water, so we have these great differences. Sometimes you taste a little mineral from the sand or the clay that the oyster was growing in. Everything comes out through that oyster. So the less you have on it, the better it is. But truly, when I do fundraisers, I love to dress these little things up. I've worked out recipes with candy and cream and sea foam and jams, and just the possibilities are endless.
Hey, if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. We do have a call here from Suzanne in Middletown. Hey, Suzanne, what's in your mind?
Oh, hi, John. I wanted to call in because, you know, with Pete Seeger having passed recently, he has a wonderful song about eating the oysters in New Haven Harbor. And I won't sing it because I can't sing, but the refrain is, you can't eat the oysters in New Haven Harbor. You can't eat the oysters that live in the bay. New Haven sewage is dumping down on them. If I were an oyster, I'd get out today. and you can just imagine Pete Seeger singing that. It's a great song. It's hard to find. I teach at Wesleyan, and I usually play that for my students when we talk about water pollution.
Well, yeah, and we just heard the story again from the Bruce Museum about that water pollution and how it really was not very good publicity for Wesleyan or the New England oysters. Thank you so much for that, Suzanne. Well, I suppose times have changed, right, Chris? A little bit. Things are a little bit cleaner. We love New England oysters. I know Pete Seeger was trying to make a message there, but you know, you've said it before. They're really, really good, and people are drawn to this flavor.
Yeah, and safe. I would say definitely safe. I mean, there's a lot of oversight with the oysters, and you know, just go to get them from somebody reputable, and you'll always be fine.
And we just have a few minutes left, Kim, I think one of the things that's scary for some people who've never tried them before is they don't necessarily know if they're safe. They don't necessarily know what they're going to experience. Just describe to someone who's never tried an oyster, try to get them to crack one open for the first time.
You know, I have oyster virgins all the time. They come to the bar, they look at me, they're kind of creeped out by these little things, and I ask them a couple of questions. You know, what kind of flavors do you like? Would you like this or would you like that? And does size matter? And we have a little conversation, and then I pick something that I think will be appropriate for them, something that they're going to enjoy for their first-time experience. So you always want to go for, you know, a flavor that someone's going to enjoy. Those melons and those cucumbers are great for starters. The people that I buy from, when we talk about the safety of the oysters, I know them. I know them very well. It's a company called American Mussel Harvesters out of Rhode Island. They are so particular about taking care of the oysters, and in turn, when they get to me, I'm careful that they can be as well.
And I think that's the thing. If you know with any fish, if you know where it's coming from, it's really going to help set your mind at ease and be really, really good. Kim, I know that you were joined. You're asked to join the East Coast Shucking Team. What are you doing? Quickly, if you would.
I am. I'm headed out to St. Louis the first weekend in March. I want to say it's the 7th, 8th, and 9th. Shafley Beer is having a huge party. American Mussel Harvesters is sending along 17,000 oysters, and someone from the West Coast is sending another 17,000. There'll be 14 of us shucking for 2 days. Actually, it's just two services, and we are going to have a beer and oyster party.
My goodness, the people in St. Louis, they don't have oysters anywhere near them, and they're going to get all the oyster center of the universe for just a short period of time. Kim Koska is professional oyster shucker for the Max Group at Max Fish. Thanks so much, Kim. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, John. Chris, best to you.
I love you, Kim.
And thanks also to Chris Prosperi from Metro Beast and the Fooge Moose. Chris is the guy who taught me how to shuck an oyster. Thanks so much for joining me, Chris. I appreciate
Anytime, John.
Now, we're going to go away to the other room where some of my colleagues are going to tell you why you should support public radio right now. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today on the program, we're toggling between two stories. One, the history of oysters in Connecticut. We'll get back to that story in just a moment. But we're also talking about the winter storm that's ripped through not only Connecticut, but the entire East Coast. It's done a lot of damage, but it's also depleted our salt reserves, meaning that there's not enough salt necessarily to put on the roads. Governor Malloy is going to be talking about that at noon today. But right now joining us is Senator Richard Blumenthal. He's going to be meeting later on this morning with officials in New Haven to talk about this problem. Senator, as always, welcome back to Where We Live. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Wonderful to be back with you.
So I'm wondering if you can just explain, first of all, what you know about this almost nationwide salt shortage, given the fact that we've got all of these storms going up and down the East Coast. What's happening here?
Normally, in other years, communities and states would share their salt supplies. Some would have an abundant supply because they'd be spared storms. Others, not so much. This year, everybody has been hit. And so this issue is really a national one in scope. And I'm going to be visiting with New Haven and traveling to a number of other communities, both along the coast and elsewhere, to determine really what the supplies are now, how they've been depleted, how they can be restored. And I'm going to be going back to Washington, in fact, even before I go back, talking to some officials at the Federal Emergency Management Association, some of the other federal agencies about how to restore these supplies of salt up and down the East Coast.
You know, it almost would have sounded like a joke at some other time, the idea of a strategic salt reserve. But it's amazing that right now, because of this series of winter storms, the United States seems to be low. Why do you think that this has happened? Have you had any answers from people as to why we just don't have enough salt, aside from how much we're using? I mean, why isn't there more production?
Remember that in other parts of the world, salt is a very valuable commodity, much as water is. We take it for granted. I think the main reason that we may be short on salt supplies is, in fact, that we take it for granted, that we assume it's always going to be there. We don't really assess salt supplies until we need them. And, of course, when the spring comes, I can guarantee the idea of salt supplies and short supply and so forth will be a thing of the past, but that's the time that we have to plan for the next winter. And last spring was the time that perhaps we should have been planning for this winter. But, you know, keep in mind, John, this winter has been extraordinarily brutal and challenging for many communities. And so it really has been an unusual, if not unique, winter.
We're talking with Senator Richard Blumenthal, who's going to be meeting with officials in New Haven later on this morning, talking about this crisis, a shortage of salt, not only in Connecticut, but up and down the East Coast. Quickly, Senator, when the governor has addressed us the last few days and talked about this idea of whether or not the salt comes into a state reserve or it goes directly to municipalities is something that's come up time and time again. Is there, perhaps should there be, a different way of distributing something as important to our roadways as salt than we have right now? Could we envision a different way to get municipalities the products that they need to make sure they can treat the roads?
There may be a need to assess how the salt's distributed so that some of the communities that may have excess supplies are in a better position to share more quickly and more readily with others. I think the governor is very responsibly and effectively addressing this issue, and I think he's right to be on it, as he is, and I intend to work with him, take direction from our state and local officials as to how they think the system ought to be done. But I view my job as providing resources they can decide how to divvy them up.
And just so the people understand, when the governor talks about an emergency declaration and he's requesting assistance from the federal government, what exactly does that mean? I mean, what is it that he's asking for here?
Good question. It means that he's asking the appropriate federal agency, and we'll have to determine which one is the best and most effective to meet this need, to assess the salt supplies, provide resources, maybe funding. And our delegation, I should emphasize, this really is not a single senator or representative. It really is going to be our entire delegation. Rosa DeLore, for example, in New Haven, John Larson in Hartford, Jim Himes and Joe Courtney along the coast, and Elizabeth Esty up in the northwestern part of the state, all of us working together on this issue.
We've been talking with Senator Richard Blumenthal. He's going to be visiting New Haven later on today, their Emergency Operations Center, talking a bit more about the salt shortage. Coming up at noon today, Governor Dana Malloy will address the state to talk about this issue. Senator, thank you so much for joining us here on Where We Live.
Great to be with you. Thank you, John.
Today in the program, we're talking about two issues. They're both a little salty. One has to do with road salt, whether or not we have enough to get around. The other is the humble oyster. It's been a food product in New England for really thousands of years. Now you buy oysters for maybe $2.50 a pop, and they've become a little bit of a delicacy. We've talked about farming them. We've talked with people who handle them professionally. But another story about oysters is how the economic model for oyster farming can be devastated by some sort of a huge event, like, say, the BP oil spill. Nyla Jefferson is director of Vanishing Pearls, the Oystermen of Point of La Hache. It's a documentary that talks about what happened after the BP oil spill to the oyster harvesters there. And Nyla, I want to welcome you to Where We Live. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So where did the idea for this documentary come from?
Well, I'm from New Orleans, so when the spill occurred, I was very aware of what was going on. Point of La Hache is about 55 miles away from New Orleans, southeast of us. And so I'd visit down there just to see what was going on. And you could tell that the community was just really, they were really concerned about what could happen as a result of the spill, whether it was the oil coming into their shores or the use of dispersants or the freshwater diversion that was pushed in to try and push some of the oil out. They knew all of these factors could have a terrible effect on oyster farming, and it has.
Well, and tell us a bit more about what we know about the impact it's had. I think one of the really scary things for all of us up here watching the BP oil spill was we knew that there would be immediate environmental catastrophes that happened, but then we also assumed that there would be things down the road that we wouldn't be able to anticipate. Tell us about what we do know right now about the impact.
What we do know right now, Point of La Hache is on the east bank of the Mississippi River, and that's the waters that they oyster fish. We do know that reproduction has not come back since the spill. It has not rebounded, and that these fishermen, as a result of that, these fishermen and the fishery families that live in Point of La Hache, Louisiana, are not able to fish, and they haven't been so since about 2011. So recovery has not occurred, even though we see these ads that BP puts on just about every television station and now in just about every paper saying that they've made people whole down there. In fact, oyster reproduction has not returned, and we don't know when it's going to return because, like I've said, the reproduction hasn't even begun.
What exactly has happened as far as restitution? Have you talked with oystermen who've at least been offered something, some sort of bridge until they can once again farm, or have they essentially been left out in the cold?
Well, here's the problem with restitution. The predictions were that within 2 to 4 years, things would be back to normal. And in some areas they are, but particularly where these fishermen fish and where most of the Louisiana oysters came from before the spill, that has not been so. So a lot of these guys took those payments hoping that things would come back to normal, and we're almost 4 years out from the spill, and we still see no reproduction. So I want to say the average payout for a lot of these fishermen was about $20,000, and so that's put them in a very, very hard position, and it's essentially pushed them below the poverty line. Over, I want to say, 4 years, if you have $20,000 over 4 years, you're living off about $5,000 annually to get by. I mean, people are really not able to survive in the way that they were pre-BP oil spill.
We talked a lot about how oysters are cultivated here in New England. How are the oystermen in that area, or how have they in the past harvested their oysters? Tell us a little bit about the process that they have to go through to get this product in the first place.
Well, let me say this. A lot of these people are in this industry, and their families have been in this industry for centuries. It's a job that they really love to do. They get up 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, and they set out. And so they're really enjoying the landscape. They're enjoying the independence. They're enjoying being out there all by themselves. They push for about 3 hours. And once they get to the appropriate spot, they drop their dredge, and they go to work. And they harvest the oysters from the water bottoms. And that's what's caused the problem here. Because dispersants were sprayed during the BP spill, it's essentially coated the bottoms. And so oyster spat, oyster larvae are unable to catch, and they're unable to reproduce since the spill.
And an important thing that you said, along the banks of the Mississippi River there, you're dealing with a very, very delicate ecosystem that is supposed to be a balance between fresh and salt water.
Mm-hmm.
That balance has been obviously disrupted, but for any number of reasons, because of floods and other things, this just seemingly adds to the complexity of growing a very delicate product in a very environmentally delicate place.
Absolutely, it does. When the spill occurred, the state opened the various freshwater siphons that we have along the Mississippi River to try and push out the oil. And so those oysters that were alive then died. So we lost that crop. But that didn't affect reproduction. The dispersant is affecting reproduction. However, what's going on now is as a result of the BP spill and the fines that have to be paid to the state of Louisiana, they really want to focus on coastal restoration. And in order to restore the coast, the state wants to put in more freshwater diversions, which is essentially going to cause the same problem that we had before. And oysters are not going to be able to thrive in those types of conditions.
Of course, one of the things that we talked about earlier in our program is we were talking about the history of oyster fishing in Connecticut, is that periodically something will happen that reduces the confidence in a product. Whether or not the oyster fishermen of Point of La Hache are able to eventually get back to doing what they did before, we mm-hmm. hope that they're able to. But because of the specter of the BP oil spill and these dispersants and all the worries about the cleanliness of the water there, is there worry that if they're ever able to grow oysters there again, that people just won't buy them because they'll be worried?
Well, there is that worry. I think at home there's a bit more support just because we want to see these people rebound. Outside of the state, I think it's harder to convince more people that it is a safe product. And I don't necessarily know how we get over that hurdle. I think it's a bit better since the spill. Just after the spill, Louisiana really had a hard time convincing people. I don't think confidence has returned in full force at all. And I don't know whether it will. That's another hurdle that we have to perhaps overcome. But hopefully for these fishermen, once things do rebound, I think that'll be a sign that the waters and the estuaries are indeed healthy. We say that the oyster is like the canary in the coal mine. If it's able to grow, that shows you that the estuaries are indeed safe and healthy. Mm. And so once we see a regrowth of the oysters, then I think that should help rebuild confidence.
Nayla, I feel like this story that you're telling here, this micro story of these people mm-hmm. farming in this one place, is really telling us up here in the Northeast, again, another tale about the Gulf Coast or about the New Orleans area, much like after Katrina and then the BP oil spill, in which a few years on we think, well, that problem's been solved. Everything,
right.
I'm sure, is back to normal. Can you just talk about whether or not you feel confident that your region is going to come back from the environmental catastrophes that it's had over the course of the last couple of years, as seeing as how the rest of America has almost turned its back and said, you know, they can deal with it themselves. That must be over now.
Well, unfortunately, I think that is the case. A lot of people have turned their back and they think that we can just deal with it ourselves. We absolutely need the support from the rest of the country so that we can rebound. We have had our fair share, my goodness, of catastrophes down here, but we are resilient people, and we really do hold on to our culture and our heritage, those things that make Louisiana really, really just special within the United States. So we're going to keep on trekking. We're going to keep on trying to make things right and try and have a balance between these industries. We understand oil and gas is important. They very much support our economy. But then we also have to balance that with the seafood industry and these people who really have put our state on the map as far as tourism and things like that. So we just have to find a balance of both. But we really do need the support of the rest of the country so that we can truly rebound from these catastrophes.
Well, I'm very glad you're able to share your story with our listeners. And the film is called Vanishing Pearls, The Oysterman of Point Alahash. Nayeli Jefferson, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Our program today is produced by Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown with help from Betsy Kaplan. The executive producer is Katie Solarski. I'm John Dankosky. Thanks so much for joining us, not only today, but all throughout the year on Where We Live. Now let's listen to a little bit about how you can support Where We Live.